Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. Today, we're featuring a project called Black in Appalachia. It highlights the lives of Black Appalachians. The project is about to launch a new podcast, hoping to generate more conversation and engagement with the region's Black youth.
To make Appalachia something that they can feel proud of and that will empower them to not only stay, but to strive and fight to make this place a viable place, all of the things that they need to have good lives in this region.
And we'll hear the story of 12-year-old Juniper Ballou, whose great aunt first introduced her to the craft of turning buckskins into handmade leather.
When I was younger, she helped us make moccasins for ourselves. That really struck me when I was younger. I was like, wow, you can make stuff out of this.
Juniper recently began learning how to make her own buckskin with a mentor, Talcon Quinn.
And I want the youth to grow up knowing that there are these skills that were kind of lost, but they're not forgotten. We still have it, and we can make it something new that's viable for today.
You'll hear these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. Across the globe, so many minds are wondering, how will life be different post-pandemic? How could it be better? Will we change our society to deal with structural racism? It might all depend on our youth. Today's show features several people inspiring and empowering young people. We start in East Tennessee, where our colleagues at the public television station there have been documenting the lives of Black Appalachians in a multimedia project called Black in Appalachia. The station is producing short documentaries and also curates a community history database. And now they're adding another element. In August, the project will launch a new podcast. Jessica Lilly brings us this story of how it all got started.
8 years ago, William Isom began working on a series of short documentaries about the history and experiences of Black Appalachians. But as he began to record conversations, he realized there were so many people within these communities with a wealth of stories to tell. The project grew to help empower more Black people in our region to learn to document their own stories.
One of the things that we realized early on was that there was a broader need within the Black communities in our region for broader documentation processes. And so seeing that need, particularly with the materials that people had on hand and the materials that residents had in their homes, oftentimes it's an older woman that's like the keeper of everybody's business in the town. And so how could we then provide support for these people's collections that they had in their homes? These communities aren't just dead Black and white history. They're living and breathing communities that are vibrant and thriving today. And so we've just been kind of building it out as communities tell us what their needs are in the documentation and telling of their own stories.
Isom himself is Black. Until he began hearing these oral histories, he never realized just how many similarities his family's stories had with other Black Appalachians.
I guess I'm the first generation in my family that never lived through formalized segregation. My dad lived all through the segregated time period. My granddad was a sharecropper. And then you go on back and people were enslaved labor in the region. And so I think understanding my place in time in the and in the region allows me to see that actually there were some detrimental impacts to the Black community through the desegregation process, though it had to occur, really ripped apart the cohesion and the fabric of the Black community in the region, because we lost so much. Dr. Bill Turner, who wrote the book Blacks in Appalachia back in the 80s, I heard him say once, he said once that Black folks have lost their stuff. And in lots of cases, that's true. We've lost a lot of our schools, the cultural and social infrastructure that held the community together and provided support for our youth. And oftentimes what you see, the only thing that's left in these communities is the church. And so lots of times we've lost all this physical infrastructure, and people have outmigrated through the opportunities provided by desegregation, whether it's the military or looking for factory work up north. And so what I see personally in the region is that there's now this there's been this ongoing lack of support for our Black youth in the region. And now what we're seeing similarly is that the lack of that support, like real material resource support for our young people, has we've thrown them to the wolves. And so now what we see from my perspective is them trying to create and maintain their own space and agency within the region, saying, no, like, this is my place too, and this is how we want it to look.
In addition to lived experiences by Black Appalachians, the series also features historians. Their research often unpeels the many layers of Appalachian culture and our own racial history.
One of the things that we tell each other in the region is that slavery didn't exist in the mountains. Right. Like because of the topography. That's the big thing people say. Because of the topography and everybody was poor, there were no slaves, very little slavery in the region, which through our data collection and research, it illustrates that that was absolutely not the case. There were thousands and thousands of slaves in the region. All components of our society have been built and maintained by the exploitation of Black labor. That's an inescapable component of who we are as Americans, and the Mountain South isn't that different than the rest of the country.
One topic you'll find in many of the stories Isom's documented is the role of education for Black Appalachians. Let's listen to a clip from a video about Black communities in coal camp towns throughout eastern Kentucky. Many of the Black residents who once lived here left the state. Della Martin Watts now lives in Cleveland, Ohio, but she remembers fondly the deep community ties that were formed inside the one-room schoolhouse she attended.
I went to an all-Black school from kindergarten to the eighth grade. I went to Everett's Black School. My kids, they couldn't fathom a one-room schoolhouse. So one year we took our kids to Kentucky and they saw the one-room schoolhouse. And my kids said, this ain't nothing but a little box. But see, it wasn't that many children. You had one teacher taught one through the eighth grade. And after you got to high school in ninth grade, you went to Harlan.
See, U.S. Steel owned the school. They bought the teachers in. They built the building. And the kids didn't have anything else to do but go to school. They had a truant officer. They would come down to these schools and check the list of the ones that didn't show up. And about 8:30, 9 o'clock, they were at your house. Checking on to see why the kids didn't go to school.
This building we're sitting in now, where I started first grade. Education was paramount. Our parents, our teachers, our clergy just insisted that we make education the number one issue in our lives.
That was P.G. Peoples Sr., Gene Austin, and Della Martin Watts recalling their education at Black schools in eastern Kentucky. It's from a video segment called The Eastern Kentucky Social Club from a series called Black in Appalachia, which is directed by William Isom.
Education was seen as a way to get out of the mines, to raise yourself up, to not having to do this back-breaking, dangerous labor all day, every day. In East Tennessee, in the farming communities, education was seen as a way to get off the farm. You know, you had everything that you needed on the farm. You had food, you had clothes, you had shelter. But the one thing that you didn't have on the farm was money. And a way to, like, increase your station in life was seen as education. And it's really interesting for me in this region where we're at, you know, in a 200-mile stretch in a mostly rural area, you had, you know, four historically Black colleges. You had Knoxville College, Morristown College, Swift Memorial Institute in Rogersville, Tennessee, and then you had Bluefield State in Bluefield, West Virginia. So, and you had this stretch of a network of Black colleges in East Tennessee. And so I think that and East Tennessee and Southern West Virginia. And so I think that was unique in a lot of ways. There's other parts of the South that had, you know, dozens of historically Black colleges in close proximity, but in a region that's considered to have very little African American presence, to have these really well run and maintained Black institutions of higher learning in a mostly rural mountain region, I think really speaks a lot to the dedication and the value that newly freed people and people living through Jim Crow had and saw about the value of education.
These educational institutions across Central Appalachia were not only interconnected with one another, they also helped bring many Black communities together. Culturally and across the state lines, they found similarities. But over time, as many of these schools closed and integrated, some of this regional solidarity was also lost. Another part of the series I found interesting explores how systematic racism began after the Civil War. So much of this history isn't taught enough in public schools. Here's historian Lester Lehman.
Because race relations in the South were being called into question once slavery was ended, as long as it was this understood position that whites were masters and blacks were slaves, everybody knew their place. You free the slaves, now nobody knows what the relationship is and what the new place is. During Reconstruction, we thought we were going to reconstruct what a new society without slavery would be. Turned out we didn't do very much, and it was pretty much left to the people to sort out for themselves. And the South, including Tennessee, sorted it out based on white power. Whites had the power, economic power, political power, authority. They had the majority of the population. They were the ones who had been most discomfited by the abolition of slavery. So if slavery was illegal and they couldn't have slavery, they had to reinstitute some kind of superior subordinate relationship. And that was segregation. Segregation based on Jim Crow laws.
Jim Crow laws were racially discriminating laws that meant to keep the whites and blacks separate, but also to keep the black Tennesseans subordinate.
That was Tennessee historian Bobby Lovett. Before him, we heard another historian, Lester Lehman, talking in a video produced by East Tennessee PBS. It's part of a project we've been talking about today called Black in Appalachia. William Isom is the director of the project. He says the history of these Jim Crow era laws is important to understanding the relevance of racism in Appalachia.
So this is another component of how we got to where we are. The way that the Appalachia looks today was created by violence. Violence against black communities, whole black communities. In 1918, all the black people after a lynching were forcibly removed from Irwin, Tennessee. In 1919, all the black people in Corbin, Kentucky were forcibly removed. The same thing happened in around Grundy, Virginia. And there's dozens of lynchings that occurred in southern West Virginia and along the Kentucky border with West Virginia. And so all these things are occurring sequentially. And so then you get desegregation and out-migration. People don't leave their home unless there's a reason. People don't want to leave their home. So economically, people were forced to leave the region. Black folks were forced to leave the region. And they were forcibly removed from the region in lots of cases. And Jim Crow provided that legal structure where that violence could be undertaken with no repercussions to the people in power. And it's really interesting, particularly to see, if you look at the city councils and the county commissions of the counties in the Mountain South, oftentimes those last names are the same last names of the people that owned slaves in the region in the 1860s. So how did we get to where we are today? We've not went anywhere else. This is where we've always been, I think, as a region.
That's William Isom, director of the Black in Appalachia Project from East Tennessee PBS, speaking with Jessica Lilly. Their new podcast launches on August 8th, a significant date to many Black people across the country. Up next, We'll hear more about the podcast and hear from one of the hosts. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, an occasional segment here on Inside Appalachia where we explore the history and folklore of Appalachian towns and their names. If you've traveled along I-79 and seen signs for Big Chimney just north of Charleston, you may have wondered, just where is this chimney and how big is it really? Nestled close by are the towns Quick and Pinch. Where did these towns get their names? Well, we're the curious sort, so we set out to get some answers. We'll tell you about what we found after a quick break. Sorry to put you in a pinch. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Alrighty now, for the stories behind Quick, Pinch, and Big Chimney, we sent our associate producer, Eric Douglas, to nose around and see if anyone could help us out. And as often happens, the best resource around is a local librarian. I'll let Eric pick it up from here.
The towns Pinch and Quick are nestled along the bank of the Elk River. They're only about 13 miles away from Charleston, but they have their own identity. For example, if you're from what the locals refer to as Up Elk, you know that Pinch is pronounced Pinch. And the local lore of how the towns were named is pretty straightforward.
Pinch is named for the Pinch Creek, which is not that exciting. And Quick is named for the Quick family.
That was Ellie Tieford, the manager of the Elk Valley Branch Library. There's a creek that runs through Pinch called, you guessed it, Pinch Creek. Tieford says that name came about during a particularly difficult time from the early settlers' history.
Pinch Gut Creek because there was a lack of food in the area for the pioneers.
So they were literally feeling a pinch in their gut and named the creek after it. As for the neighboring community, it was named after the Quick family. They were also early settlers. Without that historical context, it can be kind of funny that two towns named Pinch and Quick are right next to each other. It's actually led to a lot of jokes over the years in the community. Here's Caitlin Jordan. She's 25 now, but grew up in Pinch and attended Pinch Elementary School.
All I know is that I would get pinched if I said it in elementary school. Hey, what's the name of our elementary school? I can't remember.
Pinch. Funny.
You all said right. Pinch, you're going to get pinched.
A third community in the area has an unusual name, but for a completely different reason. Here's Tieford again.
Big Chimney, which is where the Elk Valley Library used to be, is named for a big chimney, a large chimney that produced salt in the Elk Valley, which salt was a big industry along the river.
While it may sound utilitarian, the chimney itself was a local landmark. It even inspired a poem. The verse was discovered on the back of an old photo of the brick chimney. Here's Tieford reading it.
The poem is called The Big Chimney. Marred and stained by the rush of time, it stood close by the riverside, a landmark to all nigh sublime who lived round the countryside. 'Twas the chapel slaves that molded each block from the plantation just over the way, and Quigley with chisel fashioned each rock in the base and coping gray. Hold on, there's more. The corner was torn by the lightning's flash that the vines strove ever hide, and down the face a ragged gash the years rove wider and wide. 60 feet it lifted its towering crest from foundation laid in lime and clay, a silent sentinel barring its breast 100 years today. Evan Doctridge is gone and plans are forgotten, and the salt-making industry is dead, for the ravages of war invaded the spot and left defeat in thread.
That poem is attributed to William W. Wirtz, the mayor of Charleston from 1923 to 1931. A news article from the Charleston Daily Mail in 1928 details the day the chimney collapsed, brought down by high winds. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eric Douglas in Charleston.
True story, Eric lives in the community of Pinch, and the Caitlin Jordan he spoke with is his stepdaughter. He says the people in Pinch make jokes about the town name, although pinching is kept to a minimum. Have you spotted a town or a river with an interesting name and asked yourself, what's the story there? Send us a note, and we may just go find you the answer. We're at insideappalachia@wvpublic.org, or send us an old-fashioned but still much appreciated letter. Our mailing address is 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. Earlier in our show, we learned about a multimedia project called Black in Appalachia. Now we're going to learn about the new podcast, which goes by the same name. For the new Black in Appalachia podcast, Isom joined up with Dr. Nkeshi El Amin, one of the show's co-hosts. El Amin is a professor of sociology at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. Jessica Lilly spoke with both of them about the new show.
So the Black in Appalachia podcast sort of came out of, honestly, a friendship between myself and William. I'm a sociologist at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. I study Black Knoxville within the context of Appalachia.
The Black in Appalachia podcast's other co-host is Angela Dennis, a journalist and literary activist.
I think that it's very important because as someone who was originally born in Appalachia and kind of moved away and then ventured back, I think it helps to educate people on the Black history in Appalachia. It's, I think, less told. So for me, you know, I'm learning a lot just, you know, from being on this project. So I think it's beneficial to people in the region who feel like their history has been lost.
The podcast is meant to educate people, both Blacks and whites, about that history. El Amin says they're hoping to appeal to young people.
As soon as they become about college age, it's sort of expected or sort of encouraged for them to leave the region, right? And so a part of what we're doing with this podcast is really holding space and claiming space for young Black folks in the region to stay home, right? To feel connected to this region, to see your history and to see how that history can help you to navigate the contemporary moment and really just be affirmed in your belonging to Appalachia and your identity as a Black person in this region.
And like the Black in Appalachia video series, the podcast will feature interviews and oral histories. El Amin says there's a history of racism which is often untold in our region.
The podcast is created with young Black folks in mind, right? A lot of the work that we're doing with the Black in Appalachia initiative, we get a lot of middle-aged people sort of attached to that. They see their stories, they can tell their stories. But really we're thinking about and want to highlight and want to, like I said, like we keep saying, make space for young folks, right? Like to make Appalachia something that they can feel proud of, that they can cling on to, and that will empower them to not only stay, but to strive and fight the injustices and to fight to make this place a viable place in terms of the material, you know, economic resources, political resources, all of the things that they need to have good lives in this region. I think that these histories have been documented in different ways. And so part of what we're doing is trying to get some of that documentation, right? So we might not have a lot of written history or some of it might be obscured. So like we are digging and finding it and bringing it, making it visible, right? So doing some of the census research that we're doing, some of the mapping projects, right? Really uncovering places that seem to not be there anymore or, you know, are no longer in people's memory. So I think the information is there, the histories are there, the stories are there, and we're helping to bring them and make them visible and really to empower Black folks as knowers and doers of history, right? So that in cases where you don't have something that's written, your grandmother or your great-grandmother told you the story. And so, you know, we're validating those stories as legit stories, as valuable stories, and making them visible.
The Black in Appalachia podcast officially launches on August 8th, a day that's celebrated by many Black Tennesseans as their Emancipation Day.
August 8th really is like most other Emancipation Day celebrations, right? It's about Black folks getting together, whether that be in somebody's backyard, in a park, at some sort of public space, and really celebrating, right? So there's music, there's food, they're friends, people are dressed up. It's just a big celebration.
William Isom says he grew up thinking of August 8th as a time for picnics and parties. Recently, he's been learning more about the historical significance of August 8th.
So when the Emancipation Proclamation was issued by Abraham Lincoln, it did not apply to the state of Tennessee because it only applied to states that were in rebellion to the Union. And by that time, Tennessee was already back in the fold. Then military governor of Tennessee, Andrew Johnson, who would then be Andrew Johnson, the vice president and then president. Andrew Johnson was the military governor of Tennessee under Union occupied, under Union occupation. He freed his personal slaves on the 8th of August, 1863 in Greenville, Tennessee. So from that, Samuel Johnson, who was a slave of, it was an enslaved person of Andrew Johnson. Basically, he's credited with like creating 8th of August as the day to celebrate emancipation, which was in fact his own manumission day. And so, and he's credited with some way, somehow spreading the 8th of August across the region as the day to celebrate emancipation. And there is some historical note about a speech that Andrew Johnson gave around that time that ultimately freed the enslaved population of Tennessee. And I think out of that came this you know, over 155-year celebration of the 8th of August as our Emancipation Day.
And all this history has even more significance during the current moment we're in. The killing of George Floyd by a police officer has ignited protests across the country. Both black and white protesters are demanding change in racial equality. It's also brought more interest from the white community into learning about black history. Holidays like June 19th and August 8th. Elamine says she has mixed feelings about this.
This year, this time, during this particular moment of violence against Black lives, we've seen an overwhelming, level of support from white folks, right? And while it's appreciated, while allyship is important, and it's important that all people understand and work in support of protecting Black folks, it still sometimes feel. You know, we're still not very trusting. It's hard to be trusting when, you know, these things have been going on forever. Every 2 years we see another uprising, you know, it makes you wonder, well, why this moment, right? Like, why are people choosing to step up and to say something in this moment, right? And it also makes us really kind of cautious about, well, is this just something that's popular right now, and so everybody's jumping on board, or will we see this sort of sustained effort, right, to make sure that Black people receive the same freedoms that all people receive, right? And so we don't want Emancipation Day and our Juneteenth celebrations or our August 8th celebrations to become sort of whitewashed and become almost just symbolic, or even like we see Cinco de Mayo, right? Just kind of an opportunity for frat guys to drink beer, right? Like if we're going to stand up and say that Black Lives Matter and join Black folks to fight for our liberation, then we want to see this sustained across time in different contexts, right? In our workplaces, in our schools, at the local government level, at the national government level, at our state level. We want to see real institutional changes, transformative changes, things that will really make a difference in the way that people live their everyday lives, so that freedom is not always something that is ish or approximating, but that we can truly live as free people, as Black folks. We can truly be free.
That was Nkeshi El-Hameen speaking with Jessica Lilly. El-Hameen is a co-host of the new podcast from East Tennessee PBS, which launches on August 8th. You can learn how to subscribe on our website, wvpublic.org. There, we've also posted videos from the Black in Appalachia series. Children and young adults consume a lot of online media, but books are still an important window into the world. But just how inclusive is this window?
Last year, Lee and Lowe Books, an independent publisher of children's and young adult literature, surveyed publishers across the country. Their survey found that only 5% of children's authors are Black. Most books in colleges and universities are written by white authors. Next, we'll hear from a woman who is helping more Black authors, especially Black men, get their work published. Ardre Ordi is using an initiative called the 100 Seeds of Promise to bring these stories to market. Ordi spoke with our associate producer, Eric Douglas, by Zoom.
Tell me, first off, why you think it's important for the Black community and specifically Black men to tell their own stories.
You know, it's imperative that Black people have the opportunities to tell our own stories, because for so many years, you know, much of what we've been told about ourselves has been dictated by, you know, others. And so we are now at a point where the top has absolutely been pulled off to engage in meaningful conversations about racism, meaningful conversations about, you know, social injustice and economic oppression. And right now, it's critical that we chronicle our experiences according to what we are experiencing.
Tell me about the 100 Seeds of Promise initiative.
I recognized that there was a huge deficit in the publishing industry when it came to books that were written by Black men. My clientele was thriving, and it was primarily consisting of Black women. So I thought, okay, Black men are not publishing their books at the same rates, and understanding the hierarchy of the publishing industry, that Black books are not favored in ways that books from, you know, written by other authors are, then I need to do something. And so that something for me was just using what I had in my hands right in front of me to be impactful. And so that was how 100 Seeds of Promise was birthed. I decided that I wanted to make a commitment to ensure that at minimum 100 Black men became published authors with everything that I could do to make it happen.
You were already consulting with Black women. So sure. Black women were already publishing, but you were seeing a real deficit in Black men publishing. That's interesting.
If, you know, we had just say 50 books that were being published, we could guarantee that at least 43 of those would be by Black women. Hmm. And so that was very concerning to me.
So how do we change the publishing industry in the grander scheme?
Starts with acknowledging the discrepancies. When you think about the New York Times bestsellers list, and you think about who is on that list and who those authors are, you know, it's plain to see that, wow, there is a disparity, you know, in the representation that is there. And when you look at what Black authors are doing for themselves, when you look at a company like 13th and Joan, we think very much outside of the box. Our goal is not always, you know, being listed by the powers that be specifically. It's about making sure that our authors understand how to make money from their books, how to leverage their careers as authors to jumpstart other streams of revenue and income for themselves and their families. So, you know, there's a larger discussion. We could spend the whole day talking about it, but I'm glad that we are bringing that to the forefront, because there's definitely things that should be addressed in the publishing industry.
In West Virginia, the Black community has a double problem. They're also Black in a predominantly, overwhelmingly white state or community. How do you break through that secondary level of challenge?
My message has become more profoundly focused on documenting our stories for us, so that the end goal of being accepted or feeling the need to win, you know, certain prizes as a result of said book is not necessarily the prize. You know, the prize becomes your ability to create new income because you've documented your story and spoken your truth. The prize becomes making sure that the generations that come after you have access to information, have access to blueprints of how to live life, of how to overcome, of how to learn, of how to grow, of how to evolve. The prize becomes documenting your existence and recognizing that that book and those words atop paper are your I was here moment.
Is there anything we haven't talked about, anything you want to touch on?
We have a responsibility to write about this era that we are experiencing. This is the rent that we pay for being here. And so, you know, I'm really, really on a crusade to encourage people to write right now, you know, because this is a time that someone will need to understand better. This is a time that someone will need to know we did make it to the other side. This is a time where someone will need to just write to make sense of it all and to maintain sanity. As much as we don't talk about it, we are all traumatized and we are in need of, you know, tools to overcome and to cope. And so writing does that as well. So free your mind. I always say, you know, the paper always listens.
That was author and publisher Ardre Ordi speaking with Eric Douglas. In our region, we have a lot of resilient, self-sufficient people. We've been highlighting some of their stories in our ongoing Folkway stories, and now we'll hear another. There's a group of women reviving the art of tanning animal hides. It's a traditional practice around the world, as it is here in Appalachia. In recent years, though, certain tanning methods have fallen out of favor, including some that really require you to use your brains. It's called brain tanning. Hide by hide, women in the region are reclaiming this practice. Folkways reporter Clara Hazlett, a brain tanner herself, brings us this story about women tanning hides in Athens, Ohio.
In a cul-de-sac in southeast Ohio, a woman and her 12-year-old apprentice are reviving an age-old tradition with just three ingredients: a deer skin, some water, and a handful of animal brains.
It's slimy. I just gave up on wearing gloves. It'll be okay.
Talkin Quinn and her apprentice, Juniper Ballou, are tanning animal hides the old-fashioned way, using a method called brain tanning. It's a multi-step process of transforming a hairy, fleshy animal skin into buckskin, a buttery soft material stronger than fabric. It's called brain tanning because you actually soak the hide in animal brains. Since I started tanning last year, I've met other traditional tanners in the region, most of whom were men and mostly aged over 50. But I knew that I couldn't be the only lady tanning hides in Appalachia, and I was curious about other women who practice this tradition. I wanted to meet them, to find out what drew them to the practice and why they've stuck with it. That's how I found myself here, in Athens, with Talkin and Juniper.
Hey, Talkin. Yeah. I'm going to take a snack break. Okay. Should I roll up my hide? Definitely. Thanks.
Through the Ohio Arts Council apprenticeship program, Talkin is training Juniper in the art of brain tanning. Tanning requires a strong back and a stronger stomach, patience, and some serious elbow grease. But Talkin and Juniper aren't intimidated, because for them, tanning isn't just a hobby. Talkin's home is in a quiet neighborhood on the outskirts of Athens. The air is damp, and a gentle mist drifts through the open garage door. Talkin wears a Carhartt jacket and old jeans. Juniper is wearing a sweatshirt and rain boots. She's tall for 12.
Yeah, find the neck, find the membrane side, and what I would like you to do is go down the spine and put your weight into the cable. Like, have your thumbs up, put your weight into it so that you can use your weight more than, like, having to use a lot of your muscles.
Talkin is coaching her apprentice muscle, right? Through a step called cabling, a technique for softening the hide. Following Talkin's lead, Juniper leans back and pulls at the hide, abrading it against a wire cable. Back and forth, she yanks at the deer skin, one foot in front of the other. Both Talkin and Juniper are from Southeast Ohio, a cradle of forests, rivers, lakes, and the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. Growing up in the region, Talkin spent a lot of time outdoors, developing a deep appreciation for her natural environment. And in her early 20s, she began providing more of her own food.
Like, I did a lot of fishing, I did some trapping, and I used to pick up a lot of roadkill, which I still pick up roadkill on occasion, but I don't do it to the level I did before.
Talkin didn't grow up hunting or picking up roadkill. For several years, she was a dedicated vegetarian and then vegan. But in spite of this shift in lifestyle, she continued to set high ethical standards for herself.
If I was going to hunt, I had to do it using a bow and arrow and, like, make my own fishing line.
Talkin decided that if she was going to source her own meat, she wanted to be respectful and use all of the animal. That's what led her to brain tanning.
I think because I've always been a craftsperson, like, it was, and I'm not easily squeamish. I just took to it really easily and fell in love with it in ways. I mean, there's times where I don't like it at all because it gets smelly.
Talkin sources her hides from local game processors, where hides are often just thrown away after the meat is processed. After skinning the deer, she starts tanning, transforming the throwaway hides into bags, clothing, and knife sheaths. She sells these unique pieces online to a diverse group of customers, men and women, hippies and hunters, guys who drive big trucks, and ladies who do yoga.
The thread seems to be people really wanting to connect with using all of the animal, with being respectful, who really have a deep appreciation for the earth.
Talkin also teaches brain tanning to learners of all ages and identities. And like her customers, her students come from distinct backgrounds. In her last class, she taught a middle-aged herbalist, a former coal miner, a 13-year-old boy, and a queer woman in her mid-20s. Her favorite class to teach is her buckskin bikini top class.
And it's been this really beautiful thing for me because it's, you know, people of all different body shapes coming together to make something very sacred and beautiful for their body and to encourage themselves to, like, honor themselves and feel sexy. And some women do wear it as a bikini top, and then other people it's this, like, secret thing that they have underneath their clothes. And it's super special and magical and very intimate.
By sharing brain tanning with customers and students, Talkin hopes to encourage a more respectful relationship between humans, animals, and the environment. She says she understands that animal rights advocates might see tanning as disrespectful or even inhumane, but she doesn't take any of her work lightly. She herself has grappled with the ethics of this practice.
It's heavy. It's heavy work, and there's a lot of respect and, like, gratitude and even, like, a sense of grief sometimes, you know, for, like, the loss of the animals or the loss of spirit. But I also really believe that everything continues on, and by continuing on, it lives on. That's the one thing that I really hope that when people look at my work, they see, is that it's a lot of humbling respect that I put into it.
For Talkin, brain tanning is about connecting with the natural world. For her apprentice, Juniper, it's about connecting with her heritage. Juniper belongs to the Potawatomi tribe, a tribe centralized in the Great Lakes region. At a young age, Juniper was introduced to the tradition of tanning and buckskin.
My great aunt, when I was younger, she helped us make moccasins for ourselves. And so that, like, really struck me when I was younger. I was like, wow, you can make stuff out of this.
With Talcon's help, Juniper is making her own medicine pouch.
We have a lot of powwows, which is basically dancers get dressed up in their regalia.
Juniper plans to incorporate her medicine pouch into the regalia that she'll wear at tribal powwows in Michigan.
A couple years ago, I started my regalia, but since we don't go up there a lot, I didn't get that far on it. So I jumped at the chance of making a medicine pouch for myself out of my hide that I've tanned.
And while brain tanning isn't the most mainstream pastime for a 12-year-old, Juniper isn't discouraged.
When you say brain tanning, it's literally talking about a brain. So, I mean, you say brain tanning, they're like, oh my God. And you're like, no, it's just like making buckskin. And they're like, buckskin? And like, it's just hard to explain. Most of the kids at school, they're pretty judgmental, so I don't usually tell them. But I mean, like, there wouldn't be harm doing it because it's not that weird.
Juniper says that brain tanning, no matter how obsolete it might appear, still has value in today's society.
There's so much out there that has, like, shriveled up and died because people don't think it's valued enough, or it's too gross, or it's not something that you need to know.
Brain tanning might not be something that she needs to know, but it's something that she wants to know. For Juniper, this tradition is about connecting with her ancestors and their way of life.
The great thing with how Native Americans hunt, they take one and they're satisfied with it because they use all of it, and what they don't use goes back to the earth.
In Native cultures around the world, brain tanning was an ordinary practice, including here in Appalachia. In 18th century America, buckskin was currency. European settlers and Native Americans often traded food and supplies for buckskins, or bucks for short. According to regional legends, this is where the slang word buck, meaning dollar, comes from. Yet, as the fur trade became commercialized and Native Americans were forcibly removed from their lands, traditional tanning methods fell by the wayside, displaced by industrial chemical tanning. Today, the majority of global leather comes from China. And instead of using natural materials as tanning agents, most modern tanneries use chemicals. Here's Talcon.
The chemicals that they use are caustic. Like, when you breathe in the powders, it is harmful to the lungs. And then the humans who are working with these chemicals, they're in their skin, like they're in baths of tanning agent, and their skin's being affected by it. And then that's running out into the water. And then you can back up and it's like the animals aren't being treated well, and then their hides aren't really being respectful. So like overall, it's like a very disgusting global industry.
Traditional brain tanning wouldn't be possible to replicate on an industrial scale. To tan one hide takes around 16 hours of intense labor, extended over multiple days. But Juniper says that it's worth the time and effort to source and tan their hides in an ethical way.
We don't kill deer just for the hide. We're not like, oh, get away with the meat. We usually get it from the butcher, where they use all of the meat and we use the hide. So, I mean, it's not hurting the animal. It's making use of it.
Tanning has changed a lot over the years. But to Juniper, traditional tanning still holds important cultural value.
My uncle, when we FaceTimed the other day, he called it learning the language of his grandmother, because she was taken by the settlers and taught English and, like, forced to cut all her hair off and stuff. So, like, he was learning what she had been forced to forget.
Although Juniper and Talcon both came to brain tanning for different reasons, they've bonded over their shared passion through the apprenticeship program.
So I've known Juniper since, I've known her since she was a baby.
Talkin is a family friend, and she's watched Juniper grow up to be a confident 12-year-old. And when Talkin found out about the apprenticeship program, she saw the opportunity to pass on this tradition of brain tanning to a youth in her community. Juniper was the perfect fit.
She was interested in it. I mean, she'd always talked to me about it when it was going on. She knew that I spent, like, November, I'm crazy busy, and I'm covered in deer hair and blood. And she wasn't intimidated by it.
I can be disgusted, but I am not easily disgusted.
Now about a year into the apprenticeship, Juniper has experienced the ups and downs of hide tanning.
I feel like for me, one of the hardest steps is cabling, because, like, I'm not patient. And cabling just hurts my hands too much because I have really long bony fingers, and so they bend.
Like, it's physically exhausting, you know? She flashed a huge doe. It was bigger than her. I think that she's feeling the hard work, but she's learning everything, and she's been keeping a really great attitude with it.
I just pushed through it, and it turned out really good.
Through working together, Talkin and Juniper have grown closer, strengthening their intergenerational bond. Talkin says that this kind of relationship isn't unique in their tight-knit community.
Athens area, to me, has seemed to live by the saying it takes a village to raise a child more than anywhere else that I've lived in the U.S. Growing up here, I had multiple people who acted as like aunties and uncles to me, taking me under their wing and teaching me various crafts, talking to me about my life, teaching me about plants.
Now a mentor and teacher, Talkin is reciprocating this gift of community to Juniper.
I feel like we've definitely bonded over this, like a teacher-student relationship, and then our already knowing and caring for each other relationship.
I really like teaching kids, and I think one of the reasons why I want to live around here is that I want to inspire kind of a new definition of Appalachia, particularly around here where it's just so poor. And I want the youth to grow up knowing that there are these skills that we're kind of lost, but they're not forgotten. We still have it, and we can make it something new that's viable for today.
After spending the day with Talkin and Juniper, I asked to see some of their finished work. Juniper eagerly showed off her buckskin and explained the plans to sew her medicine pouch. Talkin modeled some of her own buckskin clothing, a bikini top with braided straps and a matching knee-length skirt, stained with rich colors of brown and tan. And as Talkin described the story and process behind each piece, Juniper looked on with admiration, her eyes wide with wonder. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Clara Hazlett.
Clara's story is part of the Inside Appalachia Folkways Reporting Project. Hear more stories of Appalachian folklife, arts, and culture by subscribing to our podcast. More at wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're trying to do what we think we do best, highlighting elements of the intricate tapestry that weaves the region together and listening to each other. So I want to put an extra call out now. We want to hear from you. What solutions are you seeing in your community, and what stories do you want to hear about our region? We'd like to close with a note we just got. Earlier this year, we shared a story of a predominantly Black neighborhood in Charleston, West Virginia, known as the Triangle District. Residents there were removed in the 1970s to make room for urban redevelopment and an interstate overpass. After that show aired, Tara Brown sent us this audio message.
I'm a white woman. I was born in Charleston, West Virginia in 1983. I had no idea that a decade before I was born that there was a thriving Black community and Black cultural district in the Triangle District in Charleston, less than a mile from where I grew up. I had no idea that that community was displaced for urban development. To me, it's so important that we have these conversations. So many of these things are only captured in oral history. They're not written down. It's really hard to research. I think it's so important that we know the full truth of what has happened here, the fullness and the vibrancy of communities outside of white communities, and also the truth of the pain and suffering that's been inflicted. I feel like we need that to move forward.
Thanks, Tara. We want to tell our whole region's story in this show. And we want to hear from you, your questions, suggestions, and feedback. Send an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. You can find us on Twitter @InAppalachia. Till next time, thanks for joining us as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Folkways Reporting Project. Special thanks to the West Virginia Folklife Program and the West Virginia Humanities Council. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music this week was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Jake Sheps, and Kaya Cater. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Andrea Billups. We had help editing this episode from Helen Barrington from PMJA's Editor Corps. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Visit wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There you can also subscribe and download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.